Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday from 4 to 5 here on News Talk 580 KMJ. If you haven't heard the show before, we are always joined by veterans, specifically veterans of World War II, those who've been called the greatest generation and a dying breed. Close to 2,000 World War II veterans die in our country every day, which underscores the urgency of preserving their stories for posterity. It's an effort that I've been working on for the last 3 years. There are a lot of dedicated volunteers around the valley who are working in those similar efforts. We'll talk to one of them a little bit later on in this show. In fact, we'll talk to a member of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association who was not at Pearl Harbor. In fact, he wasn't even born when Pearl Harbor happened, but he'll tell you how you might be able to get involved in honoring that history. And boy, did we have a wonderful ceremony Friday at Fresno's VA Medical Center to honor the 66th anniversary of December 7th, 1941. Also, I have a special set of orders from General Patton that I want to share with you a little bit later on today. I got that from the gentleman who will be featured on CBS 47 tonight. That's Fresno's Bob Ha. I think you'll enjoy these orders that were sent to the Third Army in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge, which, of course, the anniversary of the start of the Battle of the Bulge is coming up a week from today. But the bulk of this program today will be dedicated to a frogman. Before there were ever Navy SEALs, there were frogmen, and the man you're about to meet was one of the pioneers in that department. He is Sanger's Bob Baird. Bob, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here, and good to see you again.
Thank you, Paul. Glad to be here.
Now, you shared with me when I first caught up with you for the TV version of Stories of Service, probably, I guess, a year and a half or so ago, you shared with me the book that you had written about your experiences, The Journeys of Underwater Demolition Team 6. But I know that wasn't the start of your military journey. What did put you in the armed services? I know initially you weren't thinking Navy. You wanted to be in the Air Force, didn't you?
Initially, I didn't want to be in anything. I got caught in the draft. I had a low draft number, and I was watching it pretty close. When Pearl Harbor was bombed, I was working for a cattle ranch in Minden, Nevada, trying to establish a six-month residence so I could go to the University of Nevada for no tuition, since I was a country boy that was tight. So I was pretty well done with getting my...
You were ready to go with that deal.
Becoming a resident of Nevada
right
when this happened, and I didn't know what in the heck to do. So.
And I know all your friends in Sanger will tell you that's what you get for leaving Sanger.
No, yeah. Well, I conferred with my fiance and my mother, and both of them said, "Hey, just take it easy for a while. Let's see what happens." So, well, I took it easy till after my end of my first semester in school there, and my draft number was coming very close. So I decided I better jump now, or I'll be digging foxholes someplace. So I went down to the Navy recruiting station in Reno, Nevada, and said I wanted to be. I went down to Air Force recruiting station in Reno, and I said I wanted to fly. And the guy said, "You do, huh? Well, just a minute. We got a short physical to give you." Well, in about 15 minutes, they declared that I was unfit to be a pilot in the Army Air Force, and because I had broken my nose when I was a kid, when I fell off a haystack and cracked it on my knee. And so I just said, "Well, I can't stop here." So I walked down the street. In about 2 hours, I was a sailor. And from there, the rest became a sailor, stayed in college till summer of 1943, when my Uncle Sam said, "We want you to report." So it must have been 1st of July, I reported to the Navy V-12 program at University of Oklahoma in Norman, Oklahoma.
And this was a pretty revolutionary program at the time. This was very exclusive and something that was just really getting going.
I hadn't got that far yet. from the University of Oklahoma. I went there for a semester, and then was sent to midshipman school at Notre Dame University. And at Notre Dame, they were in a hurry to make officers of us, so I got through in 7 weeks. They used to call them 90-day wonders. They called us 49-day wonders. And from there, first duty station, since I was in the construction Seabees, I was working on being a civil engineer. I went in the construction battalions, and they weren't. So got sent down to Camp Perry, Virginia. It was about the muddiest hole in all of Virginia, and full of sailors bored to death of what they're going to do. And one day there was a bulletin board, a big piece on the bulletin board. Wanted sailors. Enlist now, get a 15-day leave. Well, the stampede went on.
Everyone wanted a piece of that 15-day leave.
Everybody wanted a piece of that, so...
There was a catch there, though, wasn't there?
Yes. This guy was a salesman. Draper Kaufman, he was a Navy Academy graduate who couldn't get into the active Navy because of his eyes. So he'd gone to work for he'd gone over to Britain and got involved in a bomb disposal unit. He was a gutless rascal, well, I'll tell you that. His dad was an admiral in the Navy, and his dad said, you know, after Tarawa, when a horrible crossing of the reef caused so many young Marines to drown between the landing craft and the beach.
They all got hung up on the reef.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So Admiral Turner said, I've got to have some way of finding out what is in front of the landing craft and to take them out if they find something. So out of that came, that was the unit they asked me to volunteer for. And I originally became a member of Naval Combat Demolition Number 97, which consisted of 6 enlisted men, 1 chief, and 1 officer. And we trained in Fort Pierce, Florida for 7 weeks, learning how to, I don't know why they trained us the way they did. We learned how to carry 8-man rubber boats over our head and how to carry them over rocks and whatnot, and how to find our way into the beach at night and a few things like that. And of course, the final 2 weeks they taught us how to shoot explosives. And that was the fun of the part. They heard those great big bangs go off. So anyway.
That whole time, from the time you volunteered to the time you finished training, at any point during that time, did you have a real idea or any inkling of the kind of things that you would actually end up facing?
Hey, if most of us had known that, we probably wouldn't have joined it. That, you know, you're young and impressive. I was just 1941. I was 20 years old then, and not very worldly and whatnot. So I went to camp from midshipman school in Notre Dame, went down to Camp Perry, and like I say, we were sitting around there, nothing to do, and this Kaufman came along, and he said, he offered us to leave, and so we met him, and he said, how many of you want to go? So then we said, tell us some more about it, and so he did, and he glamorized what it's going to be, and it won't amount to much, and so forth, and so.
Not to mention that 15-day leave he promised was exactly 5 days traveling forward and back.
How soon can we have the leave? He said, as soon as you put your name on the line, we'll arrange for transportation for you to get to Richmond, Virginia, and catch a train. In fact, we'll arrange for you transportation all the way home and buy you tickets all the way home and all the way back. You know, that's pretty good for a guy that hadn't been home for about 9 months and hadn't seen his mother, or his dad, or his fiance, and so we went and caught the train. There were 5 of us from the West Coast that caught the train in Richmond, went to Chicago, and in the middle of us, just a blinding snowstorm, and the 5 of us came out and I said, how in the heck are we going to get to the Dearborn Street station where the Santa Fe leaves? And pretty soon there's some taxi driver. You boys wanting to go someplace? Well, yes, we are. Can we get... Well, he said, if you're game, I'm game. And he says, we slid sideways and crossways for about 5 blocks and finally ended up at the Dearborn Street station, and the train was just starting to move, and we caught it. 5 days to Fresno, 5 days at home, and 5 days back to Camp Perry, Virginia. What a glorious 5 days at home that was.
Worth the 5 days coming and going.
Every bit.
Well, I'm going to stop you right there, Bob. We have to get to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll find out what Bob actually did as part of Underwater Demolition Team 6 in the Pacific and how he earned a Silver Star. That's next as Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Before that commercial break, you heard us visiting with Sanger's Bob Baird, who traded that red of the Sanger Apaches for navy blue, and you heard about him volunteering to be part of a naval combat demolition team. He would end up in the Pacific. After Tarawa, you heard him explain the need for reconnaissance, for men who could actually get under the water and see what was there to make sure that ships and more importantly, LCVPs would not get hung up trying to get to a landing, as so many did at Tarawa. So not long after that, Saipan, the battle happened there. And Bob, I understand that was your first taste of combat.
Yes, after we left the training, Fort Pierce, we went to Maui for 6 weeks, loaded us aboard an old Navy four-stacker that had been converted to passengers, and our first invasion of Saipan on June the 12th, 1944. Have no idea what we were going to do. By then, we were called... Underwater Demolition Team 6. They took 10 of those NCDUs and put us all together. Our main job at Saipan was to swim to the reef and find out where there were gaps in the reef. If there were no gaps in the reef, to
make some.
Yeah.
Use your explosives and make some.
We were on an alternate beach at Saipan, and we went in and we're standing by, and we're on call if we were needed. And first, we got to stand and watch the first waves go in, and so forth and so on. And then we went back to our ship for a while, till the next morning. Then they had some more beach they wanted us to swim and to remove the obstacles, or if there were any. So we went to that on the D+1 and did that. We did that for about 3 hours, and quite a bit of stuff came our way. There were borders. We could see machine gun bullets landing in the water beside us, but not one of us ever got hit. I don't know. That's quite the word Lucky Six came from, I guess.
Yeah, UDT-6 would be known by all the 112 men in it as Lucky Six, and it sounds like you were lucky that day, but you saw so many who weren't lucky that day.
Well,
what was that like
that
for you?
That was I grew up that day. The saddest thing I'd ever seen in my life was young Marines, dead Marines, rolling in the surf about an hour after the initial invasion. And that was, we were just, I don't really know how to explain it, but anyway, that's what we did. And so we stuck around Saipan. The little ship we were on did picket duty because they had a radar outside of the landing and whatnot. But one of the great things I saw in Saipan was the Japanese throwing their babies over the cliff.
Mm.
And if you've never read a book called Suicide Cliff or some of that, people should read it and understand. The Japanese soldiers scared the civilians. There were about 5,000 civilians on Saipan when we invaded it. And when we left, there were six left that surrendered.
Because the soldiers had told them what they thought the Americans would do to them and scared them into taking their own children's lives.
They said, well, the Americans, first thing they'll do is rape your baby, kill your women and rape your kill your babies and rape your women. So you just as well throw them over the... Told, and they ordered the women to throw their babies over the cliff.
Just awful.
It was... Yes, it was awful. The only survivor from Saipan was the guy that jumped off the cliff and landed in a lagoon and wasn't killed. And he was picked up by the Navy. But we were within probably... couple hundred yards of that and saw that happen. It was hard to believe that Japanese could do that.
Yes, I'm sure it's still disturbing in your mind when you think about it now.
I don't think about it too often, but it is. It's there.
Now, as far as what you and the rest of the men of UDT-6 did there, and you talked about you had to see where there were gaps in the reef. If there weren't, you needed to create some. How many of those gaps did you have to create? How significant was the work you had to do there to allow the access?
Well, in Saipan, we were pretty lucky. We didn't have to remove any coral. Just were fortunate enough to find gaps that could take two or three landing craft abreast, and that our work was done. You know, someone said, how much work did you do in World War II? And I said, about 4 days, and that's just about right.
Well, and more of that would come in the dark. When you got to Guam, you didn't have night vision goggles back then either.
Our next invasion was Guam. Well, we went to Tinian for a few minutes, for a half a day looking for some stuff, places where they take in landing craft. Then we fell back a little while for a few days and regrouped and went to Guam. And our first assignment at Guam was to do some... reconnaissance at night. And
obviously that poses different challenges when it's dark out there. You don't know what you're looking for. You hear things, I imagine, and you're in the water, which doesn't help.
Well, we broke up into small crews. There were about four crews on a regular landing craft, and we had rubber boats. And we had a rubber boat crew of there were six of us. Three men were to stay with the rubber boat, and three of us were to swim in and see what was going on the beach. And so we found out very shortly that it was a dark night. We found out very shortly that you can see some at night if eyes haven't been exposed to the light at all. And we also found out that there's enough surf noise that we can talk. So we'd swim along and talk with each other, and one guy says, I think we've gone in far enough. And the other guy says, oh, now, come on, let's give him a good report. And I said, well, I don't think we want to go too much further. And the other guy says, come on, let's get the hell out of here. And I said, no, let's finish our job. So we finished our job. We had to swim back to get to the landing boat. It was about a 30-minute swim to get out. They didn't want to get those people too close to shore. And while we were in close, we could see the Japanese lighting their cigarettes, and we could see them, hear them talking.
How far away would you say you were from them?
40 feet.
40 feet away,
yeah.
In the water. Talking to each other, just like we are now.
Well, we didn't talk after we got in that close.
Not that close. The surf wasn't that loud.
But... we went back out. It took us about three-quarters of an hour to swim back out to our boat.
What would have happened if you'd been discovered there?
They'd probably shot at us, I would imagine, if they could have seen us. That was the thing. That was our cover, was darkness. Because the Japanese, with their thick glasses, they didn't see very well at night, particularly after they'd lit a cigarette. You can't see anything after you've had that much light in your face. So,
was that exciting for you, or nerve-wracking, or both?
I don't think most of us didn't have to go to the bathroom very much after that for a couple hours. Anyway, you know, we came back out and we were laughing and whatnot, And it just seemed like an adventure at the time. So we, 2 days later at Guam, some Marine general came out and he called our skipper of the team and he said, you know, we got a beach out here. We're going to bring some bigger ships on. And he said, can you open us a channel? And we said, sure. We got 35 tons of Tetratol we want to get rid of before we go to the next invasion. And he said, well, this is where it is. And he either sent one of his fellas or I don't know how to mark, but they put markers on the beach, the gap they wanted to blast. And as soon as the markers were put, we loaded all the stuff, four of our platoons, that we were divided into platoons, loaded as much stuff as we could, and in about, I suppose it took us an hour, we would swim out and swim the packs were over, they were in backpacks.
The explosives were?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And swim it in and then tie it together with Primacord. Primacord was about like the size of a 3/8-inch rope that you could loop around a block of explosives and go to the next one, the next one, the next one, and set the fuse down here and the whole works would go at once. And so we got, it took us, I don't know, a couple, 3 hours to get this all done. And one of the guys said, I think we ought to shoot this in two shots. He said, it'll make such a big, big explosion. And the big chief we had said, come on now, don't be chicken. Let's do it in one shot. Show them how big of an explosion we can make. Well, we did it in one shot. And it made one heck of an explosion. And then within 2 hours, the bigger landing craft were going across it to land supplies. And we came back out and our work was all done at Guam. Retreated to Eniwetok. They had some R&R there for us. In fact, they had an island they called, a recreation island. They called it Beer Island.
I wonder why.
You never saw how many fights a sailor could get into after he'd had two bottles of 3.2 beer. Goodness gracious. Our group was telling the Navy how much braver they were than they were, and then there was a few Marines more guys got hurt at Beer Island than in our whole service in the whole Pacific.
It was more dangerous than swimming with explosives on your back.
More band-aids and whatnot. They didn't have band-aids in those days. They just wrapped it around your head.
Well, Beer Island or no Beer Island, I know that you had some close calls. And when we come back, I want to touch upon what probably was your closest call at Peleliu. We're visiting with World War II frogman Bob Baird, Hometown Heroes, here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lafler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Time always goes by so fast on this show. We're with you from 4 to 5 each and every Sunday, visiting with World War II veterans like Bob Baird, the old Sanger Apache, who turned into what was the predecessors of the Navy SEALs as he worked on an underwater demolition team, UDT-6, in the Pacific. You heard what he did at Saipan, at Guam, and from there it was on to a situation that would probably be tougher than everything he faced before that at Peleliu. What was that like, Bob?
Peleliu was by far the... It wasn't the hardest work we did. It was the most bullets to dodge. We got to Peleliu and started to do some day before swim to see what was going. And I was, and we got, that's when we got shot at the most. One of my closest ones was sitting in the kind of in the bow of the boat on a box with my knees spread, and all at once, whammo, someone said, oh, somebody hit us. And then some guy looks and says, oh, look, Baird, you got splinters in your pants. And sure enough, the bullet had gone between my legs. And one of the guys says, well, lucky for you, you'd be singing soprano the rest of your life. And so, but anyway, that's what we did.
We're talking like an inch or two, right? That close?
Well, how far can you spread your legs and get missed 3 inches, you know, when your knees are on it? So it's not a, the jab was a good shot if that's what he was looking at, but looking for. But anyway, that's one of those things that happens. And we're just, again, lucky six at work. It was hard to believe.
Well, and I always like to, when I talk to veterans, especially those who weren't married before the war, to see how many children and grandchildren would not be here if that veteran didn't come home from the war. With you, there's another level to that, based on that story.
A couple of levels, yeah. Anyway, from Peleliu, we came back to an anchorage and had another beer island experience. And finally, well, we'd been promised if we went to four invasions that we were done. Well, you know, like every other piece, part of the U.S. government service, nobody probably keeps their promises. So they came and our skipper said, they've got one more for us to do. And we said, where's that? He said, that's the Philippines. Oh, my God. Where are we going? He said, going to go to Leyte. Where's Leyte? And so they put a big map on a ship and showed us where Leyte was. And we took set sail for Leyte, and about 2 days out, we're in the doggonest typhoon you ever felt in your life. At least I thought it was. The little old four-stacker we were on was rolling about 45 degrees, and the design for it was 46 was maximum roll, or we'd inverted, and we were alongside a battleship, and it was just barely wiggling in the surf, so in the ocean. So it was a lot of fun on the old, that we said we rode it like a cowboy. And anyway, we came through that and got into Leyte Gulf the day, well, we stayed out of the Gulf, Leyte Gulf, the night of the big Navy engagement, when really the U.S. forces, the U.S. Navy became, the Japanese became no more element as far as Navy was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went in the next day, and skipper says, well, doesn't look like there's much to take out, but here's the places you got to swim. So we went and swam the beach and didn't find anything. Sandy beach, a few water buffalo there, and not a bit of action on the beach. It was surprising. It's kind of, I suppose you'd call it a lull before the storm. But the next day, the landing hour was 8 o'clock. And so the landing craft came in. They had a lot of landing craft. We had 137 ships in the convoy going to Guam, to
Leyte.
Leyte.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning, didn't have more work to do, and we were on the anchorage, and someone listened to the radio and said, hey, I understand old dugout Doug's going ashore pretty quick. How many of you want to go ashore with me? He said, I'll put a boat in the water. So he put a boat in the water, and we headed for the beach. And we probably I doubt if we were more than 50 or 60 yards from MacArthur when he made his famous speech, I Have Returned, with his pants wet up to his knees. Rather memorable thing.
Did you have a sense when you were sitting there that that was such a historic moment? Did you understand the grandeur of it for him and for the country?
No, because most of us didn't care much for MacArthur.
Well, after bailing out of Bataan and Corregidor, I suppose.
He was a pompous old SOB, they all said. But anyway, it's one of the more memorable events, as I look back, the things that happened in World War II. The most memorable part was about 3 days later when our skipper said, okay, got everything ashore, got everything battened down. He says, we're heading back to Maui.
That was great news.
That was great news. Well, that wasn't, didn't get there as quick as it sounds. Went back to the anchorage at Aniwetok and got on the liner, the President Hayes, the liner was
ocean liner.
Liner in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And they had converted it for passengers. We Four of us officers were in a room that was built for two, and they put bunk beds in instead. And they fed us well and whatnot. And we were on it for, well, we were there when the Mount Hood blew up. I don't know if anybody remembers that. Mount Hood blew up. It was an ammunition ship that had three ships beside it. And when the smoke cleared, nothing. There was nothing left. And we were probably about, I would guess, a mile and a half from where they were anchored. You could sure feel the concussion, the wind from it.
I always talk about World War II veterans being witnesses to history, because each one of you saw things that were unique to you. And for you, man, you witnessed a lot of history.
That's right.
I know that they would give you the Silver Star for what you did with UDT-6 at Saipan and Guam and all of your engagements. But there was something that you prized a little more than the Silver Star, and you were in a hurry to get home and meet her again.
Well, that was in December, middle of December. We got back to Maui on Thanksgiving Day, and our skipper kept saying, I know I can get you guys leave. Well, our leave came on the 15th of January, and we went to Pearl Harbor, loaded us on an old motor ship. And we were 5 days getting to San Francisco, and we got to San Francisco early on a Sunday morning, and we landed in Alameda. And the first thing that three of us said, how in the heck do we catch a bus to San Francisco so we can catch the train? So they got us over there, and I went down to transportation. They said, and I wanted a ticket to Fresno, and the young lady said, just a minute, and she said, we have the Streamliner leaving for Fresno at 9 o'clock. No, arriving at 9 o'clock. And I says, well, tell me when it leaves. I'll sure be sure and be there. And so I found a telephone and called my fiance, called Phyllis, and I said, meet me at the bus at 9 o'clock. And she says, where are you? I said, I'm in San Francisco. And I didn't hear anything for a few minutes. And finally she says, oh, my gosh, I didn't think, never thought you'd get me home that soon. Anyway, I said, will you meet me? She says, you bet I'll be there. So
she made you nervous there for a second, didn't she?
No. Arrived in Fresno. What a glorious sight was to see her stand there waiting for me. And, you know, after 9 months in the Pacific, it was it's what everything we waited for. Anyway, she said, let's go out. She lived in Sanger, and she said, and was going to Fresno State at the time. And she said, let's go out. We'll go out and see my folks. And so we went out to see her folks, and we walked in, and her folks were, you know, hugs and handshakes from my future father-in-law and all that. And my future mother-in-law says, well, you know, if you kids, I think we can put a wedding together in a couple of weeks. And Phyllis said, oh, no, we won't be here, Mom. She says, why not? She says, we're not going to wait that long. So that was on the 20th. And on the 25th, the United Methodist Church in Sanger, we had 165 people there to witness a wedding that took place at 8 o'clock that night. And that's when we got married. After that, we returned to to Maui, had a 30-day leave, returned to Maui, and discovered it was like a government project, the wrong orders were given, and so we were sent back to Fort Pierce, Florida. So, ASAP, so they got us a flight out of Hickam Field at midnight, in a couple of nights, and aboard a brand new DC-4. It smells new even.
And I understand that while you were there in Hawaii talking about witnessing history, you saw something else that years down the road maybe months down the road, you would understand the significance of. Some big planes that would end up dropping some bombs.
Oh, yes. Well, we were on an island leave. We got an island leave, and three of us went over to Pearl Harbor, And we messed around and whatnot, and went sightseeing, so went back to bed one night, and we had a BOQ on the third floor of the balcony that looked out at Hickam Field. And, it's early in the morning, and this guy comes shaking. Hey, you guys, he says, get up, I want to show you something. What do you mean, get up? Well, come here, he says, I got to show you this. So we went out and saw the first flight of B-29s to go to the Pacific. Saw 17 of them land about 30 seconds apart. What an awesome sight then that was. So my friend Bill says, hey, Baird, he says, I saw a Jeep downstairs, had the keys in it. Let's go over and see what they look like. So as Navy people do, we borrowed things that were available.
The way you put that.
And went over and looked at the crew of these guys. These guys looked like high school kids.
Mm-hmm.
They were young. They were, 18, 19-year-old kids flying these planes. And we talked to them, bragged about how brave we were and how great airfields we'd clean for them, and then visited with them a little bit. And then we had to go back to Maui and there for about four more days till they got us headed for San Francisco, and I got back to San Francisco, and I called my wife then. I said, meet me at the plane at 9, and all I could hear was somebody crying. And she says, where in the world are you? I said, I'm in Fresno. Fresno? I says, yes, and I'm heading for Florida in 5 days, and you're going with me. And she said, finally her dad came over and says, we'll be there, he said. And so they met us at the train at 9 o'clock, and 4 days later we were on the train headed for Fort Pierce, Florida. Fort Pierce, Florida took 5 days and five dirty days and nights on a train. We got into Chicago to change trains, and we were walking down the street, and this young lady came up and she says, is there anything we can do for your folks? And Phil says, is there any place that we can find a take a bath, change our clothes, and get a decent meal? And that lady says, yes, right down the street, the YMCA Hotel. And she said, they take good care of you. They've even got a press it while you wait place in the basement. I said, what do you mean, press them, by the way? Well, she says, you just stand behind the wall, take off your pants, and hand them over to the presser, and they press them and hand them back to you.
Got to keep looking sharp for the Navy.
From there, we took another day and a half to get down to Fort Pierce, Florida, and settled in, found a room to stay in. Not many places for people to live. And about 15 days later, I was sent to Norfolk, Virginia, to the receiving station to screen fellas from the Atlantic Fleet who were interested in becoming frogmen. So I spent the rest of my time, there's about 8 months there, and
And obviously you were well qualified for that. And
well, I had a lot of fun doing it. I don't know how qualified I was for anything, but I could tell, it was easy to tell who was gold bricking and just wanted to get off the board ship and who was really serious about this. And I met some really great guys that were serious about what they wanted to do. And I arranged for them to have a physical, then arranged for their transportation to Fort Pierce. And we were in Fort Pierce, Virginia when VE Day came. And a great, huge celebration then. We were there when Roosevelt died, and that was a very sad time. All three of the times, when VE Day came, when Roosevelt died, and when
VJ
Day came, we had gone to the show downtown in Norfolk, Virginia. The two buildings in Norfolk, Virginia were air-conditioned, and one of them was the theater, and a lot of people went there just to cool off. It was hot and miserable in Norfolk, Virginia.
All these memories are so crystal clear, Bob, and I'm so thankful that you came and shared it with us today. We're getting short on time here, but I want to give you a quick moment. I mentioned the book that you had written before and that I'd read, The Journeys of the Underwater Demolition Team 6. I know you've written a new book that chronicles your upbringing, your entire life, your wife Phyllis's life, and your experience in the military. That book's called Children. Children of the Valley. It sells for $15, and if you want to get your copy, you can call 559-891-0775. I'll try to give you that number one more time. But, Bob, I would like you to read to our listeners, before we hit this commercial, the dedication in your book about the journeys of Underwater Demolition Team 6.
Well, I've been also writing a newsletter to all the old frogmen, but in this I wrote the dedication of the journals of UDT-6 are dedicated to the following. First, to all the men who went through training at Fort Pierce, Florida, survived and became frogmen. Second, especially to the 112 men that became Underwater Demolition Team 6. Third, to the wives and families of Team 6. And fourth, to the widows and survivors of Team 6 that have ended up being caregivers. These that have truly honored the commitment they made when they answered I do to the questions, for better or for worse, sickness and the health. These are the real heroes of the greatest generation. God bless every one of you. To all the Team 6 and their families that have gone to frog heaven before us.
Well said. Well said, Bob, and well written.
Thank you.
And thank you for your service to our country. Thank you for being here today. And thank you for listening. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, if you went out to Fresno's VA Medical Center Friday for the 66th commemoration of Pearl Harbor Day, you heard a gentleman reading the names of former Pearl Harbor Survivor Chapter 8 members who are no longer with us. He does a great job of that each and every year. His name is Tim Springer. He's the secretary for Pearl Harbor Survivors Association Chapter 8, even though he was not at Pearl Harbor. He's a much younger man. Tim, tell me why you got involved with Pearl Harbor Survivors Association.
Well, part of it is the fact that when I was a kid, the relatives would get together and they would sit around, and the uncles all served in the war in Europe, and three of them served in Europe, and one of them served in the Pacific on a Jeep carrier, and then that sparked my interest in World War II. And then I came down here to Fresno and got my graduate degree in history after getting my bachelor's degree at Humboldt State, with the emphasis in battles and tactics and military history. And then I got involved with Leon Webster, who is a Pearl Harbor survivor, and got to know him. And he said, why don't you come on board, and, you know, we know you're interested in this, and we know you have done a lot for us already by just being a historian and writing about that. So I said, sure. And I came down, and I started volunteering my time, and then one thing led to another, and then I was made an honorary member when they instituted that particular part of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association, associate member and then honorary members after that. And so and we just help out. That's part of what we do for the chapters, is to do what we can to help these guys out.
Well, I know everything you do is very much appreciated by the veterans themselves, their wives, their families, their survivors. You, I know, have also recorded interviews with several Pearl Harbor survivors over the years. What are you doing with those?
Well, eventually I'm going to try to make a documentary called Pearl Harbor Remembered. Mm-hmm. So I've got about 15 survivors that I've recorded so far on videotape. I've got another about 40, 45 World War II veterans on videotape as well, mm-hmm. including my late father-in-law who just passed away, Jim Leiter, and he was he was a D-Day veteran and saw action in the Battle of the Bulge. So eventually it'll be a Pearl Harbor Remembered, and then maybe a documentary about World War II from the guy's point of view, because
mm-hmm.
they're the ones that lived it.
Exactly. They're the ones who are the authorities, because they were there. And we will look forward to seeing that when you finish that life's work for you. I know it's a labor of love for you, for sure. If there's someone out here who was at Pearl Harbor, who isn't a member of the association, or maybe someone like you who wasn't there but wants to get involved in helping to keep this legacy alive, what could that person do to get involved?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, they can come to the meetings. We meet on the third Sunday of the month at the Hometown Buffet in Clovis, usually about 11:30, 11:15, 11:30, and just start coming, volunteering, get to know people. There's some contact numbers I can give them if they would like, if they're a survivor and haven't joined, would like to, or like to volunteer their time.
Go for it. They're listening.
The first is our president, chapter president, Don Merritt, and his number is 439-9232. Our vice president, Guy Harden, and his number is 582-7115. And then there's myself, and that's 645-0800.
So you can't go wrong with any of those three. And Tim, I apologize that we weren't able to carve out some more time for this. Maybe we'll have you on the program again in the future, especially with when Pearl Harbor comes around and when that's a theme. Again, one more phone number if you want to get Bob Baird's book. That's 891-0775 for Children of the Valley. Tim, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all that you do for the Pearl Harbor veterans.
And thank you, Paul. I appreciate being here.
And we'll have you again. I promise you that. We are running out of time here on this edition of Hometown Heroes. We'll be back again next week from 4 to 5. I don't have time to read you General Patton's orders during the Battle of the Bulge, but that'll be perfect for next week, because next Sunday will mark the 63rd anniversary of the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge, and you can get a little taste of that on CBS 47 tonight with the story of Fresno's Bob Ha and his unique service during World War II. That's going to do it for the program this afternoon. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.